your life, so you never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil, and you fry some garlic. It's and you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. And you got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? A little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar. Delicious. And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. How are you doing this evening? Are you all tuckered out from all the fun things that were going on this weekend? And what were you able to get to? I admit I didn't go to as many things as I would have liked to, but at some point, you know, you just have to stop. I spent a lovely day at the Sebastopol Farmers Market today. It was just great, not too hot, and you know, all the fall crops just looking so beautiful. Went to San Francisco on Friday night, hadn't done that for a while. It was very nice to see Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe playing each other's songs. That was lovely, and stopped for dinner afterwards at A16 down on Chestnut Street. And there's a particular reason I'm telling you this, because there was a very interesting intersection that I think is worth discussing. A16 is really the place that brought really, really good contemporary Italian-style pizza to San Francisco. It's been several years now. They have a cookbook out. At some point, I want to get them up on Mouthful. But I noticed on the menu, first of all, they had burrata, the Italian cheese, you know, that's like a little bag of mozzarella wrapped around little shards of mozzarella and thick cream. And they drizzled it with olive oil. And that's something I eat at home quite often. In fact, there was some sitting in my refrigerator that night. They also had on the menu fried peppers, and I asked about them, and they were the little tiny peppers, very similar to madrones. And I have a standing order with one farmer at the farmer's market for a pound of padrones and shishitos every week. And I eat them almost every single night. And I thought, well, what does it say now that there's this coinciding of one of the great restaurants that's open late? We walked in at 11. It was still serving. It was full. That, you know, my refrigerator and my nightly meals are very similar to what's on this menu. And it just made me feel really good because it's like seasonal. People are just eating really good food at this moment. It just made me smile all the way home. I really just loved it. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about tonight exactly, but I have a feeling that the idea that underlies my being pleased with finding those very familiar things on the menu, I bet we're going to find some of that in this book. It is called Growing Roots: The New Generation of Sustainable Farmers, Cooks, and Food Activists by Catherine Liner, with photographs by Andrew Lipton. And we should say that Catherine Liner is the sister of a very good friend of Mouthful's, Marie Gewertz, up in Healdsburg, who has helped get many a guest into this studio. So thank you, Marie. And welcome to Mouthful.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle. It's a real pleasure to be here. And you were talking about shishitos. Mm-hmm. And they're actually one of my favorites. And one of the characters in Growing Roots, Pilar Trujillo, grows shishitos. And I was under the impression that they were nowhere other than in the Southwest. And I was so happy at the Healdsburg Market.
Oh, you found them at the Healdsburg Market.
Bought them and cooked them. How do you cook yours?
Most of the time, I put a very small amount of olive oil in a cast iron pan, get it really hot, throw them in, turn them over, blister them, put them in a bowl, and put Maldon sea salt.
That's what I do.
Yeah. Now, I confess that last night I'd been doing... In fact, if you're interested in bacon, you might want to go to my blog, the Press Democrat website blog, Eat This Now. It's the second to most recent post. I did a bacon test, tested five different kinds of bacon for which ones cooked the best and developed the snap. You have to cook bacon all the way before it gets that snap, and you have to have bacon with snap to have a perfect BLT. So I was testing, what's the best? And so I still had some bacon fat in the cast iron pan. And I poured most of it out, but left just about what normally would have been olive oil. And I cooked them in that. And then I added just a little bit of lemon juice, which is what they do at A16. And then I also served them over burrata.
Mm.
Oh, my. It was just a fabulous, fabulous combination. And I don't remember seeing shishitos in Sonoma County until this year.
Okay. That's what they actually said it.
Yeah. There have been padrones for 2 or 3 years,
mm-hmm.
But not shishitos.
And the padrones are a little spicier.
They're a little smaller.
Oh, they're smaller.
Normally. I mean, they can be picked bigger, but they will turn red eventually.
Oh, interesting.
But they're picked normally a little bit smaller than shishitos, and they're called the Russian roulette pepper. So,
and that's true.
But 99 of them might be as mild as shishitos, and then, you know, number 100 will rival a habanero. So, you know, I've had one or two hot ones this year so far. Mm. Anyway, so who was the farmer that you saw?
Pilar Trujillo.
Oh, that's right. You already said.
She lives in a small town just outside of Santa Fe called Chimayo. And it's a beautiful little town. And her family lives on a acequia, which is a water ditch. But it's a community-run water ditch.
Oh.
And Andrew is actually very good at explaining what an acequia is. Andrew.
Well, they get the water out of the river, but then they share it and allocate it to the different farms based upon community decisions. And then the community also every year gets together and they go in the ditch and they clean it.
And so there's a Mayor Dormo who is the head boss, and he can actually be old as the river. I mean, some of them are 80 and 90 years old, and they actually get paid, and they coordinate this community event that takes place twice a year, actually. It's once to clean up the ditch from the snow and all of the badness of winter, and then it's to close it down before winter comes.
What a great thing. I should also say, also in the studio with us is Tucker Hemquist. Is that right? Say it right?
That's right.
And tell me your role in the book.
Well, my role in the book's a little different than my role in life at this point. In the book, Catherine was interviewing me about olive oil making.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Now I've placed you.
Sustainable farming and a variety of other things, permaculture. But now I am with a group that is called Spiral Foods Co-op that's trying to bring a local foods co-op to West Sonoma County.
Based where?
Right now we're looking at Grayton.
Grayton, that's like right near me. I'm in Sebastopol.
Wouldn't that be a nice addition?
Yeah. And have you been making olive oil in West County?
I was up in the Geyserville area.
Oh, Geyserville, okay.
Skipstone Ranch is where
it's Skipstone. Okay, I know Skipstone.
But I'm no longer.
Oh, you're no longer there.
Now co-oping full time.
Uh-huh. So where are you with those plans? What stage?
We're still in the development stages, but
we're everywhere and nowhere at the same time. It's moving incredibly quickly. We're making connections very quickly, meeting with different organizations, meeting with farmers or local artisans, people interested in all different aspects of trying to recreate kind of a new village style mentality around a local food system.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, good luck. If I can do it, stay in touch. If I can do anything to help move that along, I would love to.
Definitely.
You know, it's a really good thing. Really good thing. So tell me about the book. What was its genesis?
Well, I've always been interested in food and eating good, healthy food. And my mother, who was an excellent cook, had breast cancer when she was quite young. So she always ate quite well. Mm-hmm. But after breast cancer, she became a fanatic. And
where was this? Where
we were in Los Angeles at the time. Actually, we started out in Washington, D.C., and that which is where she was diagnosed, and then we moved to Los Angeles, where we were living as I was a teenager there. And the book came about as a result of my youngest child leaving home at an appropriate age, and I was left an empty nester, and I found that I was loneliest in the kitchen. And so I lived between New York City and Durango, Colorado, and I decided I had to get out of my New York kitchen and move west. So I popped my dog into the car, my 10-year-old cattle dog. At the time, she was six, and we drove west. And I was in just outside of Kansas City and about to run out of gas, and I pulled off of the highway, and not a gas station in sight, but I heard a motor stop the car, ran up the side of a hill, and it was a tractor, and sitting on top of the tractor was a young man who explained to me after I said, "I need gas," that he was home from college trying to decide whether or not to come back to his father's and mother's goat farm, and he had a fiance. She didn't really want to live on a farm. Anyway, after an hour of conversation and 3 gallons of gas, he decided to stay and take over the farm, and I had my gas. And that was the beginning of the book.
Did you write about him?
I didn't write about... Well, I actually did, but I interviewed 150 young people, and there are 58 in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them are involved in sustainable lifestyles, but not all of them are farmers. Mm-hmm. We have, there's a filmmaker, there are writers, activists, an artist, mm-hmm. chef, cook, the whole range of those folks who are involved with food in one aspect or another.
And what was the threshold that they needed to cross to make it into the book?
Oh, good question. Well, first of all, my lovely photographer, Andrew, took 10,000 photographs, Andrew, is that right?
Quite a few, yes.
And so some of them had depended upon whether or not the photos were explicit. And also, my narrative runs through the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so my narrative sort of, that was the key as to where we were and so forth. Now, in Andrew's spare time, he's a lawyer. So when I tried to change the route that we had taken, he said, "Don't do that." And I was thinking that he meant for legal purposes. You know, the kids will, they'll find that you were not there on the month that you said you were there when you write. But it was really much more, I think, about my process. Is that right?
Well, it was all about the flow and the development mm-hmm. and how we went from one person to the next
mm-hmm.
and how we met people along the way. So when you try to break it up and shift it and move it around, the sequences didn't flow the same way, and the book didn't develop the way Catherine developed in interview style and what she would cover and who she would be talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, in terms of making the cut, there were some folks who ended up not being exactly what they said they were.
Sure, and that always happens.
Yeah, and so, I really felt strongly that I had to stand behind each one of these
sure.
folks.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
And they each gave me recipes,
uh-huh.
beautiful recipes. Tucker's recipes are just divine. And so there were a few that I have included that did not give recipes, but there were some recipes that were just not good.
Yes, that happens.
Or not as good.
That happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, so... what's interesting about Tucker, and he may want to enlarge upon this, is he lives his life, and he's sort of he's very knowledgeable about permaculture, which is, I would have to say, the sort of the core of this book.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want
to? We might want to do a quick summary. I'm trying to find the page that you're on too.
182, I believe.
182. We should probably give a quick summary of permaculture. We've done shows on permaculture before, but I think it's still a little bit of an elusive concept to people, to a lot of people.
I think the easiest way to think about it is permaculture is a way of looking through a lens of how things relate. And looking that your action in one place will create a ripple effect out from that place and will affect things over here and over mm-hmm. there and creatures living here and bugs and things anywhere in your area, to know that you're not acting alone. You're not acting in a bubble. Everything is related. On another level, it's about resource management. Permaculture has an idea of allowing resources to circle around your area, your, where you are, as many times as possible before they leave, so that you're using things, you know, checking functions, so that everything is being used the most efficient way possible, and that you're not wasting resources.
Could you just give some maybe concrete examples for somebody who is at home and not realizing that they could.
Exactly. So, water is a major issue with permaculture, and using water on your property. You want to build a system of berms and swales that you can keep water on your property. You want to build up a water lens around your gardening areas, for example. So,
a water lens.
A water lens would be the water that's built up underneath the ground that will stay in one place. If you can catch the water in one place, it'll build up there, and longer into the season you won't have to be watering above ground, because there's a built up lens of water underneath the ground that you can use. So allowing water to both be where you want it to be and then move it away from where you don't want it to be is kind of an example of permaculture. You know, harvesting water, rainwater from your roofs, mm-hmm. and reusing gray water, and all kinds of things like that. It's about managing resources. I think it's a major issue with our culture is wasting resources. Single use containers. We had a woman in our panel the other night at the Baker Creek Seed Bank who was the passion purveyors in the book. And they do biodegradable containers, single service type food containers. But she, but it was very, very interesting and very poignant to me that she said that in 10 years, her hope was that she wouldn't have to be creating this, that there would be no need for single service. Mm-hmm. That was her passion, was trying to get rid of all the single service. And, you know, she was only selling in her locale. She wouldn't sell to people outside of her local area, which I mm-hmm. thought was really inspirational mm-hmm. as well. So that's a permaculture mentality. It's, you know, is focusing on your area, trying to make things better, but not just being satisfied with making things better. You keep making things better, keep mm-hmm. going, and keep pushing forward.
So that it becomes a part of your life.
So that it becomes a part of your life. I mean, permaculture, they talk about different zones. Zone zero is yourself and kind of in your very immediate surroundings. And then zone one is the things that are right around you in your house. And then zone two and zone three. And
outside.
The varying levels of attention uh-huh. that you need to be able to manage those zones. And, you know, zone zero is kind of the permaculture of yourself and how you relate to people. So it's something you could explain forever, but
where did you learn about it?
So I studied primarily at the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center.
We had Doug Gosling on last week.
Oh, Duggo is a good friend.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to have a center like that so close by. It's one of the premier permaculture centers probably in the world. Brock Dahlman
is
an
amazing.
Unbelievable individual. Yeah. Among my favorite people. To hear speak, I list him with Noam Chomsky and Cornel West.
I love
my three favorite people to hear speak in the way that they
Cornel West is riveted. I like Noam Chomsky too, but Cornel West is one of my favorite speakers.
Just to listen to them speak and the way they synthesize language, and then they're right. You know what they say. It's just yes, that's right.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about the recipes that you have in the book, because Catherine really praises them.
Okay. Let's see.
I did a pulled pork BLT.
I've got the book open. Did you agree, BLT, did you agree with me about the snap?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. BLT is
snap
by
is
far
essential.
The best sandwich seasonally. The rest of the year I'll go with the Reuben, the BLT seasonally is the best sandwich out there, which I did an off-tick. I did a pulled pork BLT in here with some avocado mayonnaise.
For goodness
so it would
sakes.
Be a B, a,
B,
PPBLAT.
It took some creative license with the name.
But I wrote an entire book about BLTs, so believe me. Okay. I've taken lots of creative license. And as long as you keep the core, the bacon with snap, only seasonal tomatoes, then I think you can branch out in a variety of ways.
So anywhere other than California, you really couldn't. You could only have a BLT during the tomato months.
Well, here, I mean, I didn't have my first BLT until August.
Oh, really?
Because tomatoes were really late this year.
Really?
And certain things have to come together before I will have, I mean, it's sort of a ritual for me, my first BLT. There has to be my favorite local bacon, and it's Black Pig, and he happened to be out when we finally had tomatoes. So I waited. Not Black Pig. I'm sorry. I love Black Pig. My apologies. Black Sheep Bacon. Mm. Black Sheep Bacon from Brock Fulmer up in Potter Valley. You know, you're naughty and you must know Brock. Mm. His bacon's awesome.
John Stewart does make great bacon.
John Stewart makes fabulous bacon. I made a 60-foot BLT with John's bacon.
I actually used to work at Bovolo and at Zazu both, so.
Oh, yeah, no, John makes absolutely great bacon. Mm-hmm. In fact, I had a BLT with 5 different kinds of bacon on it. When I was testing all the bacon, I just thought, well, let's see what it's like with all different kinds, and that was fabulous. Mm. But partly John doesn't sell at my farmer's market, mm-hmm. so there's the personal ritual mm-hmm. that, you know, Brock comes with his bacon to my market, and I get a tomato from someone I know, and I get my favorite lettuce and my favorite bread, and then I have my ritual first BLT. But yeah, this year sometimes it's the earliest it's been was once it was on the summer solstice.
Wow.
A few years, maybe 3 years ago, it was
so
on
it's
the summer
like
solstice.
East Coast.
Yeah.
Midwest.
Yeah.
Bottom line, do they deliver on Sunday evenings to radio stations?
I know. Whenever we start talking about BLTs, we all really want one. Okay, so tell us about your pulled pork BLT.
Well, you know, it kind of changes all the time. It's funny for me to put recipes down because I don't ever cook from recipes.
Yeah.
I basically cook out of the garden. That's where my passion lies, is directly out of the garden.
That's the dichotomy with today's appetite for cookbooks.
Exactly. But I just did a batch of pulled pork yesterday, actually. But I feel like the really nice saltiness of the pulled pork can go really well with a nice fresh bacon, and especially if you get it for this sandwich, you can get the crispiness from the bread. I like to go a little crispy on the bread for that, because you know, it soaks up the juices from the pulled pork. So you get that bacon aspect crispiness there, and then you know, kind of getting nice fat tomato, and it goes pretty well. Are you looking for a description of how to make it?
Oh, no. I just wanted to... No,
I got the book. You know what's interesting about the recipes in this book, which I find really fascinating? Andrew and I have been going around, and we do these panels as Tucker.
You're traveling around the country?
Around the country. And I did a book club in Durango not too long ago, and everybody made one of the recipes in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I had made most of these recipes, so it was interesting to see what they came up with. Mm-hmm. If they were not a cook, some of the recipes were actually more innovative. Mm-hmm. And if they were a cook and they followed the ingredients precisely, mm-hmm. it was not necessarily as good as what I had done, I think, because I don't follow recipes. I read them through once. And then I cook them, and that would be the one thing that I would advise anybody buying a copy of Growing Roots is to try it once before you try it for company.
And I think with any cookbook, I'm a big advocate. You read recipes tell a story, and it's just like if you go to MapQuest, they're going to tell you one way to get to your destination, but you might know a better way,
right?
Especially if you're familiar with the territory, and the same with recipes.
Right.
It's one person's roadmap. And it's really come about, it came about because of the domestic scientist movement in the late 19th, early 20th century. It came about because women wanted to elevate the position of the homemaker. Mm-hmm. And then I think it also came about because copy editors needed jobs.
Mm.
That very precise, is that a quarter of a teaspoon or is that a third of a teaspoon? Mm-hmm. It's like, get the spirit. It's the spirit that matters.
Well, I used to watch my mother cooking. She would perspire and, Cavo, too much. And my father was a Jew, you know, and Jews just throw things in. versus a Swede who's so precise. My mother was just so precise. A great cook, though.
For me, a recipe book is more about the pictures. I like...
The pictures?
The pictures just tell the story, and if I open a recipe book and there are no pictures, it's not going to ever find my shelves.
Won't buy most of my books. a few, but, for me, a cookbook is about the story it tells. I try to find the writer's voice, and if I can find that writer and find out what their personal story is, then I can go with them. Mm-hmm. But if it's something... don't want to pick on Williams-Sonoma, but why not? Because they came to mind. But the ones that are just recipes and there's no personal voice, those don't do so much for me. I like to know who it is, and I want them to tell me the story. Mm-hmm. Even if it's a recipe, I want it to tell me a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would have to say that in Alice Waters, her books, the beautiful
the vegetables and
fruits, mm-hmm. and I mean those are so, and there's not a photograph in it. There's some graphics, but they're so beautifully done, and her voice is so strong.
Her voice is absolutely
that
there.
It makes it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the other people in the book.
Okay.
How about Jessica Prentice? We hear so much about Three Stone Hearth in Berkeley.
Right.
And I actually have not been over there yet.
Well, they've moved since Andrew and I work with them. But interestingly enough, if you were to hear the diet, to hear what they eat, the amount of butter fat, whole fat.
Yes, I'm just looking at this liberal use of traditional fats, raw and cultured dairy products.
Right. One of my friends said, she had grown up, this is a Coloradian, who had grown up on a ranch, and everybody in her family had died of heart attacks. And she said, and this is the way they ate. But the difference, of course, is these are grass-fed meats. Mm-hmm. And the butter are all from cows and goats that are grass-fed.
Sounds very much like the Weston A. Price diet.
It's exactly what it is. Yeah. That's exactly what it is.
I'm a big advocate of that.
A lot of fermented foods. Mm-hmm. And they just have such a gas. Andrew, tell the story you told the other night about... We arrived and they had a big spread out for all of the employees and to welcome us.
Well, every lunch there, at the time at least, they did a communal lunch. Mm-hmm. And they would all sit down at the table and family style serving everyone there.
I love that.
We joined in, and a wonderful, expressive, talkative lunchtime. They finished up. They cleared everything up very efficiently, went into the kitchens to get back to work, turned on the music really loud.
Outstanding.
And sang and danced to a song before starting to work again.
That's so great.
And this is 10 to 12 people.
Two restaurants, and I'm not going to name them, but two extremely well-known restaurants that get the maximum number of stars from the various sources, I've heard from entirely different sources about being in their kitchens and at the employee meal at one of the places. No one talking as they're cooking. And at one point, a poor busboy dropped a spoon and got yelled at by the chef. It was like, silence in the kitchen.
Ooh.
And they all ate together. They all had their employee meal after service. No talking.
Oh, my.
During the employee meal.
Wow.
And in the kitchen of this other place, which is extremely well known and extremely expensive, the chefs work like every 2 feet, there's another chef. No talking.
Well, one of the
prescriptions, sounds like Mostly Martha.
Prescriptions for all of the recipes in this book is that they must be eaten at a family table, there must be good conversation, and there really should be a good bottle of wine.
Yes, and some good
or
music.
Beer.
Yeah, something good to drink. Excellent. Mm. That's how, if we only had family dinner at a communal table every single day, if everybody did that, can you imagine how different the world would be? Or how different this country would be?
Be fabulous.
Yeah.
Really,
they wouldn't have
fabulous.
Time for some of the nonsense that goes on.
Right.
We're actually looking for the co-op. I, as a professional chef, That's why I was hired at the previous job as a chef, but branched out to do all the olive oil and things. The Cope would like to have a cafe with just community-type lunches. Mm-hmm. I saw on an episode of Anthony Bourdain, No Reservations, mm-hmm. he was in Beirut, and they had, just off of the large marketplace, there was a little cafe that one of the guys was running, and different chefs would rotate it in and out all week. So it was a different mm-hmm. meal, but it was a family-style meal, all the dishes laid out, gorgeous, ornate dishes. And people came and served themselves and were sitting all around large tables, and I thought that was a beautiful way for people to commune and to eat.
Absolutely.
And that was a great inspiration. Mm.
Do you remember, do you know the restaurant Olivetto?
Mm-hmm.
Very early, it must have been, 92 maybe, really early, they started something called Alla Tavola. And it was a community dinner. You sat down at the table with whoever else came, and they brought out platters of food.
Mm.
And I thought it just sounded like the best idea in the world. And I drove down. And, of course, there were several people there that I had mutual friends. And not because we were in the restaurant business. It was just these random, so-and-so. Met all these people. It was also wine in crafts. It was an extremely memorable meal for all of the reasons that you say are required at the table. Good conversation, beautiful platters filled with wonderful, humble, simple, good food. It lasted about 6 weeks. It was before its time.
Mm.
You know, they just, mm-hmm. people stay. They wanted single people, families, whatever, to just come. And it was before its time. I'm always trying to get restaurants to do that. It's like, let's have a community dinner every Monday night.
Yes, it
just
would be great.
Put your tables together. Family sit down at 6. You can have a second seating. You put a carafe of red, a carafe of white, and a carafe of milk, so they bring the kids.
Well,
you haven't had any takers yet.
They're trying to do this, and I should say they're doing this. Recently, they opened up an edible schoolyard in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the minority communities, and it was after post-Katrina, mm-hmm. and the schools at that time, prior to Katrina, were all, you know, your normal run of the bad mill. They had a reputation for being the worst schools in the nation.
Yeah.
And they are now charter schools. And in these charter schools, this being the first, the food is the most important aspect. Everything comes out of the garden, math, chemistry, science.
Mm.
All the kids get cooking lessons twice a week, three times a week.
What level?
This starts in kindergarten.
Oh, kindergarten. Okay,
kindergarten,
great.
Through junior high.
Uh-huh.
Now, Alice Waters Edible Schoolyard in Berkeley is elementary school.
Uh-huh.
And recently she has also opened one in Brooklyn, which is also elementary, but this mm-hmm. goes right through middle school.
Through middle, school. That's great.
So this is the very first time, and these kids, they all help to serve the lunch. They help to make it. They help to serve it. You know, most of the schools now have no ovens. No refrigerators.
No.
They've
dismantled school kitchens.
Exactly. Cisco or whomever brings these foods in.
Yeah.
So anyway, they have glasses on the table at the edible schoolyard, tablecloths. You know, they all hold hands before eating and say some communal thing, you know, blessing the food and the work that they've put into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all clean up together. And it's all part of the process of learning. And I am just sure if we could have more of those kinds of schools across the nation.
Oh, absolutely.
Things would change very quickly.
And one of the best indicators of success for kids is the number of meals they eat each week with the family.
Right.
And it's amazing how many
don't.
Are zero.
Well, you know, the other thing with this school, which is really interesting, and it's not in a great area, the parents, somebody has to come to pick the kids up because they're bused in, but they're not bused mm-hmm. out. And when they come, the children can take home some of the food so that they have this organic food
uh-huh.
at home, and they're beginning
to
teach their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the weekends, they have actual farmers market.
Oh, that's
that
cool.
are run by the kids.
Excellent. You know, we have a program down in Petaluma that provides a CSA-like mm-hmm. subscription for low-income parents. You know, for they're working with a couple different schools, and they do it at a much lower than the usual subscription cost.
That's so
it's
great.
Subsidized. So we're seeing lots of movement. I mean, there's much more going on today than there was 5 years ago. We're going to take a real quick musical break here, and we'll be right back with our guest talking about Growing Roots, the new generation of sustainable farmers, cooks, and food activists. Mouthful here on KRCB. It's Michelle Jordan. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for sticking with us. We are talking with Catherine Liner, along with Andrew Lipton, photographer of Growing Roots, and Tucker Hemquist, who is also in the book. And Tucker, I want to talk a little bit more about the co-op that you're working on developing. But before we do that, I'm really curious for both of you. First of all, did you two travel together and photograph? I mean, as opposed to bringing you in after the manuscript is done, which is how a lot of photography is done. It sounds like you were involved in photography as the research was being done.
No, I was involved in all 40,000 miles of traveling back and forth.
That is great. That adds a really interesting dimension to the photography.
Part of the reason for that is that we didn't want posed photographs. So most of the photographs were taken with a long lens over Catherine's shoulder while she was talking to the people, so they would look like they were looking at the camera. And then the trick was trying to get them when they're not blinking, but not having their mouth open and things like that. And then a lot of photographs of animals. And then the farms or the artwork.
I had that feeling that you were involved rather than brought in afterwards. It just has that feel. And it's a nice, it adds a very nice dimension to the book.
Thank you.
And it must have, you know, having two people, you know, doing all this would have made it probably, would have added another dimension to the research as well.
It certainly did.
Well, also as a lawyer, I always had to put in my 2 cents worth. It's hard to keep quiet.
Well, it's interesting because the kind of law that you practice is really very, you know, it's very apropos with regard to growing roots.
And why is that?
I do environmental litigation and occupational disease cases. So for the last 30 years, most of my cases have been workers who have gotten cancer from exposure to different kinds of carcinogens in the workplace. And then have handled some major pieces of environmental litigation where water supplies and land is polluted and trying to arrange for it to be cleaned up.
That makes me really want to go off topic. Mining the bottom of the seafloor.
Yes.
Just been reading about that. It's like, you got to put that in the category of what are they thinking? Get those people to sit down for dinner every night around a family table.
And don't
maybe
let them
it would
get
change
up.
Them.
Don't
yeah,
ever
really.
Let them get up.
Yeah, probably find some foods with some good heavy sedatives in them. What did you all learn in, you know, maybe that's the wrong way to put it. What most surprised you as you researched this book?
Well, I would have to say that it wasn't necessarily a surprise, but it was when I started out, I had an idea, and I was kind of feeling, well, not kind of, I was feeling very sad. And I was feeling sad because there are moments where so much overwhelms can overwhelm one. And driving cross country without having a guidebook in terms of food, you know, it's one fast food restaurant after another.
Yeah.
And the truth is that that's not the case anymore.
No.
And so, you know, in Growing Roots, we give you kind of a travelogue. That was a nice surprise, and I was delighted by it. But also, the people. I just, I can't tell you. I feel so close to these individuals, really close to them, and their ideas of food and family and lifestyle is so aligned with mine. And I wish this for all of us, you know. I really, Tucker's a great example of when he speaks of permaculture and what that, you know, the way that that is a real holistic approach.
What also stands out and sort of unites all of the people in this book is their passion for their lives and their lifestyles and what they're doing. You don't see that in the everyday world enough, at least. And it really was remarkable and wonderful and inspirational to see this.
Yeah, that's great.
Across the board. You know, farmers, Tucker and all of what he, but the activists and the chefs, the cooks, the managers of the farmers' markets, the ricer, all of them, you know, they all are excited about waking up in the morning and getting to it.
Yeah, if you look at the table of contents, I won't read the names, but you just go down, food marketing, raw food cook, mushrooms, winemaker, food writer, pig farmer, farmer and writer, poultry farmer, beekeeper, filmmaker, filmmaker and farmer, activist writer, just go on, miller, wheat farmer, biodynamic farmer, architect and gardener, ricer, herbals, naturopathic doctor. That's an interesting and really interesting inclusion.
Boy, she was interesting.
Someone who makes organic ice cream. Somebody who has a community supported kitchen. TV cook and someone who makes granola. A lobster man. Public health at Tulane University, somebody who works in food and social justice. So you really have covered just a huge, I mean, what you've done is you've opened a really big umbrella and put a lot of really interesting people
I hope
under
so.
That umbrella.
And I think that they also, yesterday Bryant Terry was speaking, he's a writer and a cook, and he said, we all represent more of what's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was a lovely way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think 20 years ago, or even go back 30 years ago, there were very few people thinking along these lines. It's mm-hmm. really been a sea change, I think.
Right. I agree with you.
Yeah. And the book is, I think, a really great contribution to it. Was it a hard sell for the publisher?
Well, that's an interesting story, and the long and the short of it is that we had a lot of offers. And
you did? Well, that's great.
Well, it was great. And my agent, in the end, she said, you know, the offers are not good enough, and they didn't really cover my first four trips. So Andrew and I self-published.
Oh, you did?
And
wow.
We have a distributor, Chelsea uh-huh. Green, who is the most divine distributor. Just really splendid green publisher. Mm-hmm. And we sort of followed, I mean, what I wanted was a, you know, good paper, recycled paper, mm-hmm. Good glue. Mm-hmm. I wanted a book that basically when you got through with it, you could eat it, which is, and Chelsea Green, that's what they do. Uh-huh. So it was a perfect match for us.
Mm-hmm.
It's been
wow.
great.
That's pretty brave. Turned down offers
and
self-published.
Well, you know, I've published close to 20 books with, you know, traditional publishers.
Were there any of them about food?
No.
What sort of things were you
I wrote in my early years, they were children's books and young adult. Mm. And now I'm writing novels. I had my first novel out called Digging Out in 2004 when I have uh-huh. first draft of another one finished. Oh. So. But I do have another idea for a food book.
Uh-huh.
So we'll see.
Oh, interesting. Well, Tucker, tell us some more about this project in West County for a food cooperative in West County.
Well, it's come about as it's kind of been forced on us, really, in so many of our conversations my wife Julie and I have had with just our close friends and neighbors and community members. There's a general amazement that there isn't a food co-op in West County, and we live in such an amazing, abundant area. Mm-hmm. There's so many local farmers growing the right way and doing amazing things, but there's a real lack of locations to sell those things in a permanent setting. Mm-hmm. Farmers markets are amazing. CSAs are amazing. Farmers are doing what they can to mm-hmm. get their local produce out, but there's still a very difficult situation of trying to find
a
permanent location. There's a definite gap.
Yeah.
And a lot of that centers around trying to revitalize a local food system. And then our idea was to base that around kind of a village center type of a mentality, kind of being able to bring community members in to try to contribute to the larger whole of feeding their community. So we want to have a produce section that's largely local, as local as we can get it, and local artisans producing the value-added type food products. But we also, in conjunction with the cafe, would like to have a community kitchen. So member owners, we're going to do a kind of a hybrid worker-owned co-op and also a member-owned co-op as well, so mm-hmm. that all the community members are owners, not just mm-hmm. members of the co-op. They're part owner of it. So we'd like to do a community kitchen so owners can come in, sign up for some time to produce something, you know, whatever they do well, make banana bread or some mm-hmm. peach jam or something like that. Sign up for time in the kitchen and then be able to sell it in the deli. They can also sign up for so many volunteers, so mm-hmm. other people who want to learn how to do what they do can learn and help that person out. other things, we'd like to have a whole wall of the co-op just be a chalkboard and have a local artist do a rendition of the watersheds, and then allow people to write out where they are on their watershed and what they're doing. So people mm-hmm. can start to learn that, oh, their neighbor has goats, is making goat cheese, and I have apples. I could trade apples for that to that person mm-hmm. for their goat cheese. Things like that really bring a communal sense back to uh-huh. everything that's going on, and try to remove the heavy commoditization uh-huh. of food and the packaging. I mean, Pollan, I think, said it best in Omnivore's Dilemma that the reason why there are huge grocery stores with a tiny two aisle section of produce and then 15 aisles of packaged foods is because we can eat everything. So as long as people can try to market that to us, they can be successful. And I think that's kind of a sad departure from a holistic way of eating mm-hmm. that really needs to be reversed and turned back into a more community sense.
Yeah, this is a topic, I mean, obviously we could talk about this for hours. There's mm-hmm. so many things that factor into it, from the pricing of foods and, you know, free speech is a fabulous thing, and I would not want to limit free speech in any way, but advertising is just horrible in so many ways. Mm. And I'm going to rush home to watch Mad Men. You know,
there's... Oh, God, it's Sunday night.
I mean, there's that dichotomy. And so I think... then you go back to education. I think one of the great things is the edible schoolyard. Mm-hmm. Edible schoolyard. But we have at least one generation, possibly two generations, that didn't learn to cook at home.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Or garden.
Or garden. And, yeah. And that's a really big swath through the population.
Well, there's more and more farm-to-school programs that are yeah. popping up all over the United States. I mean, everywhere, yeah. really.
But
truly.
We've got to get the parents, right. parents today with kids in school, we've got to get
That's to part of our motivation, too. We want to have an educational center surrounding the co-op, mm-hmm. Make it and have community outreach, demonstration gardens, do a farm-to-school programs running through the co-op, things mm-hmm. like that, because it is really, education is really the key, and
yeah.
especially living in California when they can't possibly cut education funding fast enough. It's something that's going to have to be taken up by the communities, and they're going to have to really take hold of that education and try to do whatever they can to mm-hmm. reach the kids and get them out in front of the TV mm-hmm. and put them out in the garden or yeah. in front of the stove.
Yeah. Well, my grandson, Lucas, goes to Oak Grove, and Oak Grove is a great school. And they have a wonderful little garden there. They have a salad bar every day.
Ooh, great.
The kids get involved. They participate in the garden. I think it's probably the best public school in West County. You know, they have a motto, if it's not fun, we don't do it at Oak Grove. And they're just extremely, extremely supportive. I know that in previous years, and I'm hoping that it'll be next May, I guess, Mexico has this great holiday, Children's Day. Do you know about this?
No.
I think it's sometime around the beginning of May.
Oh, so May, they've got Cinco de Mayo, and then they've got Children's
Day. But there's
Day,
Children's Day.
And I bet there's Food Day, too, right?
Well, Children's Day involves food, and a lot of the Hispanic mothers get together. And I just went, I think Lucas was in kindergarten, and I went to pick him up. And there is this huge spread that a bunch of the mothers have gotten together. And great fan of chili verde. It's one of my favorite things in the world. There's chili verde, there's pozole, there's handmade tortillas. And they do a lot of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great place. Where do you see your funding coming from?
A lot of different places, mm-hmm. really. We're kind of looking at a kind of a hybridized model. We want to run a nonprofit that will mm-hmm. kind of create the center, create and run the educational center, mm-hmm. but then also would lease space to the co-op to run the grocery store. Uh-huh. So that allows a lot more diversity in where you can take funding from.
Sure.
But a lot of it is, it's pulling from different sources.
Uh-huh.
We want to try to bring in kind of the older Sonoma County landed community that mm-hmm. has land that may not be farming it or not farming all of it or whatever mm-hmm. the case may be, and try to connect them with younger people, permaculturists, biodynamic farmers mm-hmm. who can't afford land in Sonoma County but would like to farm,
Wasn't that what County Line the Little Farm County line. They lease land. They mm-hmm. grow on land that they don't own. And I know a few farmers
that do that.
There
are several organizations. We've actually talked to several of the organizations, yeah. Sonoma Open Spaces, Farm uh-huh. Link, other things like that. That are, you know, we want to try to bring a synthesis also in the organizations that are trying to establish local food systems also and have mm-hmm. everyone working together and pooling resources so that we can have a unified movement to have a vibrant local food system.
We're just about out of time, and I want to talk about an event you have coming up. Tucker, if people want more information about this, how do they... Is there anything in place yet?
So far we have, you can contact us, we have an email account, Spiral Foods Co-op, plural foods co-op, the Spiral Foods Scoop, if you will, at Gmail.
Okay, that's Spiral Food Scoop. I mm-hmm. think it's easy to remember. At gmail.com. That's perfect. Thank you. You're going to be, or let's see, Catherine
and Andrew.
Okay. You're going to be at Copperfields in Napa at 6
Correct.
P.m. on
October 5th.
Is that Tuesday?
Tuesday.
Gosh, I know what it is. I know what day it is. And what you'd be discussing the book, we'd be having another panel discussion?
No panel this time. We may indeed have a PowerPoint. Uh-huh. And we'll see about that. We'll see what sort of size group we've got. But the book will be available, and Andrew and I will be there signing. And it's actually a celebration for Wells Fargo employees, I think. But the public is welcome. Everybody, come along.
Great. And to get the book, because you're self-published, and even if you weren't, I would ask this question. What is the most beneficial place for you for people to buy it?
Well, I would say... It doesn't really matter.
It
can be Amazon growingroots.info.
Oh, growingroots.info. Okay.
You can buy it from online.
And then local bookstores?
And local bookstores. Copperfield, in this area, Copperfields and...
How about Reader's Books in Sonoma?
I think so.
Okay.
I think it's probably available everywhere.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully. And if it's not, ask for it again and again.
There you go. Yes, ask. Always ask.
Right.
Well, on that note, thank you so much to all three of you for taking time on your Sunday
thank
evening.
You very much.
And Tucker, this just makes my day hearing that this is going on in my backyard. So really, keep me posted and let me know what I can do to help you out, because it's a really exciting thing.
Thank you very much. And we'll be popping up. It won't just be email. We'll be popping up, and we're starting to do farmers markets and talk to the farmers and things like that. So you'll start seeing Spiral Foodies, Spiralinos, we're calling ourselves, popping up to talk to people and start signing people up, and so the people can be on email lists and be aware of what we're trying to do. Because, I mean, this is going to be a community project. Mm-hmm. When you ask about funding, it's the community is what's really going to push this mm-hmm. forward. So
great. Well, fabulous. And on that note... Mouthful has come to an end. Again, time flies when you're chatting on Mouthful, doesn't it? Meet me back here next week when my guest is going to be Dan Imhoff, who has been on at least twice, maybe three times. He's written another truly remarkable book. This is a big, physically big book. If you have any questions and concerns about factory farming, I think it's safe to say that Dan can probably answer any of them. This is an exhaustive look at factory farming. It's really an amazing book. And on that note, take care of yourself, have a great week, and meet me back here on the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. It's Mouthful and Michelle Jordan.
Just say.